Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from June 17th to June 23rd. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So this week, I actually put out a blog post. So it was basically titled How Set Protocol Works Under the Hood. It was talking about the DeFi Primitive Set Protocol, which is basically a way to bundle assets together and trade these kind of tokenized representations against different strategies and things like that. So the article basically just runs through how that all works and how when you're buying like a set from the token sets platform, it uses Kyber's on-chain liquidity reserves to source the liquidity and things like that. It's really exciting, actually. Like while I was digging into it, I was like, there's just an unlimited amount of ways that you can construct these sets to track different indicators. So you can track like technical indicators or fundamental indicators and basically automatically rebalance based on what, you know, kind of signals they send out. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for this project, and I just wanted to spotlight, you know, what they were about, because I haven't seen them talked about much in the DeFi space just yet. So if you want to get up to speed on what Set Protocol's been doing and, you know, how it all works, I guess, definitely go check out the blog post linked in the newsletter, of course. The other thing I wanted to mention quickly is Consensus is having another virtual hackathon. So the link is in the newsletter. The first prize is 24 ETH, which is actually quite a lot. I think it's about $7.5 US at the moment, which is quite a lot for a virtual hackathon. But yeah, you can go sign up starting pretty much now. It's already started. So definitely go sign up and check that out if you're a developer. All right, now jumping into the news. Now, obviously, everyone's going to know what I'm going to talk about first, Libra. it's pretty hard for us not to talk about this, considering it was literally all crypto Twitter talked about for 48 hours as soon as it was announced. So it was actually announced at 5 a.m. New York time, which is perfect for me because it was like 6 or 7 p.m. my time. And I just quickly saw literally everyone on crypto Twitter start talking about it. It became a meme that everyone had a hot take about Libra. But yeah, so we've been speaking about it for like months now. Obviously, Facebook stablecoin, how they had like all these partners on board, how they were going to structure it and everything and what they were going to do. So I guess like if you haven't caught up at this point, there's a few links in the newsletter that basically take you to the Block, which had probably the best coverage of Libra. They had a whole bunch of different things that they put together, different analysis, how it all works, basically. And there's like a million tweet threads as well. Catherine Wu put together a master thread of all the tweet threads. So definitely go check that out. But yeah, so the Block had this really great article, basically listing the 10 most important things you need to know about Libra. So basically they ran through how it's like a low volatility cryptocurrency, aka a stable coin that's backed by like a basket of different currencies and assets and all that. We already knew that. It's governed by a non-profit organization, based in Switzerland. That's common for kind of these crypto enterprises. They actually plan to transition to a permissionless system down the line. So where kind of like it's more decentralized and anyone can kind of join on as a validator. But as we know, the current ticket price is $10 million to become a validator. And there's 100 limited spots in that. And we actually found out that the reason why these companies are paying $10 million to be validated on the network is because they're actually investing in a kind of security token that they can earn fees from being a validator. So that was really interesting. It kind of answered the questions of like, how would they monetize this stuff and like, what's in it for these companies to sign up? Like, you know, all these big companies like Uber and, you know, PayPal and eBay and all these other different corporations. So basically they were talking about like how it's going to be pseudo-anonymous transactions, which came into a lot of debate as well, because people were like, well, how is it pseudo-anonymous if, you know, your customers are going to require KYC to actually use Libra and use the app? You know, there's a lot of debate around this. Like, I'm not going to go through it all on the podcast, but you can read the tweets linked in the newsletter. They actually registered with FinCEN as well. There's a bunch of different regulations that they had already considered and things like that. And they're actually planning to launch this in 2020. Now, obviously, all this is quite a big deal for the crypto space. People were saying, you know, is this bullish for Bitcoin? Is this bullish for Ethereum? I think it is. Like, I think obviously Libra is more than a stablecoin. It's a blockchain that a platform that actually is going to enable smart contracts and things like that. But I mean, I don't fully believe that it's ever going to be kind of fully decentralized, especially since it's Facebook's thing. Facebook is known for kind of having a tight hold on all their products and offerings and things like that. And also this kind of stirred up the beehive in Congress where they're actually meeting, I think, next month to discuss shutting this down before it even gets off the ground, because it's basically Facebook inventing their own money, essentially. It's like a corporation inventing their own money that could actually challenge. It could go as far as challenging like maybe smaller nations' currencies or even the almighty US dollar if they get enough adoption with it, because of the fact that Facebook has 2.4 billion monthly active users. So there's a lot of different things, a lot of different considerations. Great info in the tweet threads that I linked in the newsletter. But yeah, I've rambled enough. Eric, what was your take on Libra?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot to break down here. We could probably dedicate this whole 45-minute episode to Libra, right? And we've dedicated a lot of time in the past. I'm glad the information's finally out there. I guess, if we start, like, how does it compare to Ethereum? I mean, we'd be kidding ourselves to say like it's not a threat or a competitor to Ethereum, right? Just the fact that Facebook has 2 billion users on its platform and, it has sway in the regulatory industry, even though it has, kind of a black eye on it right now, but they've got a lot of money and power behind them. So I think we'd be kidding ourselves to say long-term it's not a competitor to Ethereum, especially given they do have some smart contract language in there called Move, which could enable, some applications to be written, like potentially DeFi applications and stuff like that. To me, it's more of an EOS without a speculative asset underneath. So it's a stable currency. It's backed by, mainly just think of it as like multiple different government bonds, right? And so that's what's backing it. So that's what makes it a stable currency. I saw a lot of people say, oh, it's a non-gov money. They're kind of shoving it to government money and banks. That's not really the case, because they're going to be holding these low risk investments that back the stablecoin in banks and stuff. So it's really it's not like they're kind of creating that much of a private money. I mean, in theory they are. And obviously, like you mentioned, Congress has kind of already spoke up against it. But to me, it's more of just it's not fully decentralized, right? So if you're looking for a pseudo decentralized, stable mixture of government money, it's basically like a currency basket almost to me. Like, I guess this would be for you. I guess my biggest problem with it is, what is it really solving? Most people are probably okay, definitely in the US, most people are okay just having their US dollars and using Venmo and PayPal. So I guess then the answer would be banking the unbanked. But, I saw a pretty good tweet thread out there. Someone was playing devil's advocate on Libra. And it's like, okay, well, how does someone in a third world country go about acquiring Libra and using Libra? And can they go pay for it on the side of the street with their, somehow they're going to acquire a smartphone and pay for it and everything? So I'm just not convinced. And I think having government and Congress being able to put a face to a name is already a problem for them. So it's interesting, like the second this came out, Congress was already going after them and saying this can't happen. And they could easily blame Facebook, right? Well, that's tough to do on Bitcoin and Ethereum. There's no like one face or name that they can blame. So I found that very interesting. Like the second you could kind of blame someone for creating this, they were gone after. So that just proves to me the power of the protocols that are truly decentralized. But I'm sure it'll be a name in the space for a while. I don't think they're going to really get off the ground for probably 1 to 2 years. They're going to deal with regulatory hurdles. It's just not that much to be excited about. I mean, I kind of joke tweeted like we should build a collateral backed stablecoin on Ethereum and call it DAI, right? Because that's literally just what Libra is, really. And I mean, Facebook's going to be building their own wallet for it called Calibra, which has KYC, and they can shut down accounts if they deem it as fraud. So, I mean, to me, this isn't really the vision that I got into crypto for. I'm sure it might attract some people that maybe either just don't really care about that vision or don't know better, and it's just integrated into their Facebook apps all of a sudden they're using it. But in the long run, I'm not that scared of it like surpassing Ethereum, even though I do think it'll hang around as a bit of a competitor for a little while.
Yeah, I'm just really curious to see if it actually ever launches. There is, you know, quite real speculation around if it will ever launch, considering the fact that, as you mentioned, like the regulatory hurdles are quite steep for them there, because you can put a face to the name essentially. And Facebook isn't the most liked company at all at the moment, especially with kind of, you know, governments around the world with all the different privacy stuff going on, especially, you know, governments blaming Facebook for shaping the 2016 US presidential election and all this sort of stuff. So I think, I don't know, like Zuckerberg still has controlling shares of Facebook, right? So he still controls the company, even though it's a public company. So, you know, and he strikes me as the kind of guy that wants world domination. You know, I never met him, but like from everything I've seen and I've read, it seems like he just wants world domination. And, you know, what's better than dominating, creating a world currency, essentially? Like you can basically shape most of the world to your will if you have the dominant currency, as we've seen the US do with the US dollar and obviously the petrodollar and things like that, if people have heard of that too. So yeah, I think that might be kind of his long-term goal there with it. But yeah, the regulatory hurdles are steep. I don't know if it actually stops them from launching, considering there's like 100 different partners they're going to have on board. And you know, once you launch it, it's not going to just be a head. Like Facebook will only control one node, as they say. So it'll be 1% of the voting power. So, you know, the government would have to basically enforce, and probably more than 50. The algorithm that they're running on, or the thing that they're using, BFT, I'm getting a bit technical here. I think that requires more than 50% to kind of control the ledger anyway. But yeah, so they'd have to convince like a large portion of these companies to basically shut it down, which I don't see it happening. So maybe Facebook is just going to say, screw the regulators, let's get it up and running, and then, you know, come at us basically. So well, I guess we'll see what happens in the future. There's been enough hot takes about Libra, you know, enough speculation, I think, for now. We're just going to have to wait and see. But yeah, I think it poses like a little bit of a threat to Ethereum, I guess. But at this stage, I don't think that we should be worrying about it, considering that it might not even launch. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, they have two very different long-term visions, in my opinion. And I mean, kind of the lead of the project I saw on Twitter, and like Amin was going after him a little bit, and they were talking about privacy. And, you know, this guy was saying there's no way, you know, that Libra would ever have privacy on the base layer, which is obvious, right? I'm sure there's a plan in the long run for Facebook to sell your transaction data to other parties and profit off of you. But we talk a lot on here, like, to me, crypto is never going to go anywhere if we don't have some type of privacy on the base layer. Because I don't think people want to transact with their friends and they can trace back their entire financial history, right? I can't really think of a worse person I would want to trust with my transactional data than Facebook, right? And the fact that they're not even going to consider privacy on the base layer, which obviously makes sense if they're going to try and play nice with regulators, is concerning to me. And it's funny, like this launch, and everyone was just like, you know, there were a lot of like bad takes to me. I mean, everyone says, and I just said it, oh yeah, they have 2 billion users. That doesn't mean that those 2 billion users have any interest in using your crypto, right? Like they could all just blow it off. The other funny thing to me was to watch how no one talked about how they have no plans for scaling. So it seems like they can maybe do like 1,000 transactions per second, but there's nothing about sharding in there. There's nothing about anything further than that, or like layer two solutions. So it's funny how everyone just like ate it up because it was Facebook and it was instantly a competitor, which it is. But, you know, we didn't see the typical backlash and questioning around technical details like we normally see, especially around scaling.
Yeah, I think the reason was because everyone was talking about like the macro consequences of things like this, right? Like how it challenges existing power structures, how it challenges existing cryptocurrencies, like just from like a kind of overall perspective. But I think with the scaling, like one theory I kind of had was that even if it tapes out at 1,000 transactions per second, they're probably going to just have some kind of database that they update when users are transacting with each other, like, you know, a crypto exchange does, rather than have every transaction on chain. I think the on-chain transactions will just basically be users sending these things to things outside the Facebook ecosystem. So like crypto exchanges, for example, because I know that Facebook, Coinbase is on board as like a kind of, as like a partner. And obviously Coinbase will probably list this stablecoin to bring liquidity and all that sort of good stuff to Libra. So Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting to see how all these partners integrated too. Like, as I mentioned, like there's partners like Uber and eBay and stuff on board. So are they just going to integrate it into all their platforms instantly and say, hey, we accept Libra? That would be an incredibly powerful move and incredibly strong, because it basically makes Libra the default currency of the internet, which we obviously don't want that to happen. So yeah, I kind of hope the regulatory hurdles is too much for them, so that they just can't get off the ground. Because if they do, Facebook, you know, as we both said, has the reach and has the sway and everything to get this adopted a lot faster than any of the crypto stuff like Ethereum and Bitcoin does. All right, enough Libra talk. Let's move on to a few project updates. Now, this last week was a big week for actually Ethereum updates. So Ben Edgington is back with his What's New in ETH 2. This was actually quite a long one. So there's a few major updates in here covering basically how the beacon chain's going. So phase zero of ETH 2, we're actually about a week away, not even like 5 days away from the June 30th spec freeze. And I think that everything is going quite well there. He also mentioned that the Beacon Chain go live dates. So during DevCon 5, they want to deploy the deposit contract to the current ETH1 chain as part of like an open ceremony thing. And then there's a possible launch of the Beacon Chain on January 3rd, 2020. So, I mean, this is possible. I did kind of get like some feedback on Twitter about this, saying that this is a very tentative date. So don't, you know, count this as a concrete date or anything like that for the Beacon Chain launch. Obviously, with software development, things change very fast. So just keep that in mind. But yeah, so overall, this was great. There was stuff about phase one in there, and then also phase two. There was actually a large section about the current thinking around phase two and about execution environments and things like that. A lot of it gets a bit technical. So if you want to jump in, I definitely recommend going and reading it. But yeah, so I read this sort of stuff and I just get so bullish on the future of Ethereum, because there's so much work being done behind the scenes. Like, I was thinking about phase two a few weeks ago and I'm like, you know, how are they going to do it? Like, I haven't heard much about phase two. Like, everyone's concerned about cross-shard communication and all this sort of stuff. And then Vitalik starts talking about execution environments, and then all these other people hop on. And then there's a couple of researchers recently. I think Matt and Will, I think they both work at Consensus, but yeah, they've come out and they're doing a lot of the phase two work and basically breaking it down and all the current thinking around it as well. So yeah, it's basically, yeah, that's right. Consensus has an ETH2 phase two team known as Quilt. It's written right here. Yeah, that consists of Will and Will Villanueva, I think I'm saying that right, and Matt Garnett, the two main guys there that I've seen on Twitter interacting a lot. So yeah, it seems like phase two is coming together quite nicely already, and we're not even, you know, we don't have phase zero on mainnet yet. Did you read through this one, Eric?
I did. I guess I'll say first, let's make sure we don't get too excited, or Vlad might unfollow us, or Eric or Dean might yell us.
yeah, he sure did. Sure unfollowed us because we were too hyped. Oh, well.
too funny. Anyways, I guess on deadlines, like, I'm a fan of deadlines. I know everyone gets a little queasy because, yeah, we might miss it. But I do think at a point, and my background's in product management, so like this kind of hits home for me, I guess. But I like deadlines at a point, because they at least kind of, if not, you're just going to keep creating slippage, and all of a sudden we're going to like be mid 2020. At least if we put early January there, even if we miss it by a little bit, like, everyone's going to be feeling the heat around that time. We're going to be able to like create cutoff points and all that stuff. So I know some people were, I guess, a little upset that the deadline was set or created, but I'm actually a fan of it in the long run. I think it'll pay off. But yeah, I mean, it seems like the ETH2 team just keeps trucking along. Like, they're pretty quiet and just keep their heads down on ETH research and just coding away and making everything happen. So big props to them. I'm excited to start seeing this stuff around phase two. To me, this is the critical stage, right? Like, phase zero is great because it's like the first step in everything. But really, you can't do much with the chain, or you can't do anything at all with the chain except just accrue interest on an account by staking until we get state execution. So that's when you can actually start like doing balance transfers and start thinking about smart contracts and all that. So there's a lot of posts that got put up and talked about on ETH Research, and the newsletter covers that in the last couple of weeks. And it kind of all kicked off at Scaling Ethereum, which was that conference that happened, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks ago, which actually I got to go back. I think the videos are out there now. I need to go back and watch those. But yeah, just a lot of good work happening here, it seems. You know, I'm not going to act to be as smart as these guys creating these posts and talking about all this. But it seems this is kind of the first, I think, at least what I've seen, big steps in research starting to happen on the phase two side, and like specs kind of being put out there and ideas being formalized and stuff. So, you know, I don't know, like I've kind of just had the assumption that like every phase is going to be maybe 6 to 8 months after each subsequent phase. So I guess if that's the case, we're probably talking phase two, like middle to late 2021. I don't know if that's pessimistic or optimistic. That's just kind of the assumption I've had internally.
Yeah, I think, yeah, dates are always a hard thing at the end of the day. I think the phase two definitely getting fleshed out more and being explained more and kind of getting a more concrete spec around it is great. Phase one is just as important, I think, especially because we might be able to use the shard chains as just data chains. So we can actually start interacting with them at layer two and things like that. And definitely we have all the ETH 1.x stuff happening as well on, you know, the current Ethereum chain. So I don't think the 2 to 3 year outlook for like a full ETH 2 implementation is a thing to worry about at all, to be honest. I don't think it's going to slow down anything. I think there's still so much other stuff that needs to be done as well. You know, I don't think mass adoption's coming for another few years, at least for crypto. We're still extremely, extremely early. We haven't really found that killer app. And by killer app, I kind of mean the app that everyone is going to use, you know, like your mom, your dad, your grandparents, whoever, right, is going to use this app. At the moment, we have like kind of mini killer apps within crypto. So obviously we have DeFi and things like that, but it's very, very limited, set of people use them as well. So it's not exactly, you know, mass adoption, but yeah. So I think that's why we've got time here. And this is why I think that even competitors that launch, like, who are they launching to, right? We haven't grown the pool of people that are in crypto. Like most of the growth comes from price going up. Like the next bull market is going to bring in most of the new people that you know, that we see. And then once the bear market hits again, they're going to get flushed out as well. So that's why I think the ETH2 team taking their time to flesh all this out is very, very important and pretty much critical to the success of Ethereum. And I think they understand that. So I don't think it's a bad thing that it's going to take a little while. And I don't see any competitors knocking on the gates either. Like, obviously, we both have a strong bias towards Ethereum here, but I've looked at the other chains. I mean, like, what else is, you know, has the use? Like, nothing really. I mean, I can't even think of anything. Yes, there's competitors launching, but they're all launching behind competitors and on competitors on competitors. So it just feels like they're fighting for scraps, like Ethereum scraps, essentially. So yeah, I mean, that's a whole other conversation in of itself, but that's like kind of my current thinking around timelines with ETH2 especially.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's no reason to rush it for all the reasons you just said. I mean, there's really no legit competitors. And even on the research side for the things we're talking about, like sharding and proof of stake, I think Ethereum's ahead of any team that maybe hasn't launched yet. I mean, I'm sure there's other teams out there that have similar ideas, but they're not going to gain the network effect and usage that we're seeing on the Ethereum main chain for a while. So there's really no reason to rush it. And I think as long as phase zero goes out in 2020 and we keep seeing progress on, you know, phase one and two and eventually three, I think people are going to stay pretty bullish on the idea. And it's going to be funny, like once this stuff launches, like what are the anti-ETH narratives going to be at that point? I mean, it squashes so many things. It squashes unknown and high issuance rates. It squashes proof of stake can never work. It squashes ETH can never scale. Like what's going to be left at that point for all the anti-Ethereum people?
Oh, I'm sure the maximalists will come up with something. Like they have wild imaginations.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think they were they just have a plethora, a Rolodex of things that they'll launch every couple of months.
Yeah, and we'll just keep building. So, you know, I'm all right with the FUD. Like I'm happy defending it on Twitter. I don't really care. It doesn't really affect me personally, emotionally or whatever. I don't get emotional about this stuff. They can say whatever they want. I just want to educate people. I mean, we both want to do that, right? That's like the whole goal of ETH Hub. All right, moving on to the next big Ethereum-related update. So the EF, Ethereum Foundation, put out their kind of, I guess, part one of 2019 report. This is huge. Like, this is very long. It's like a 20-minute read. So I'm not going to discuss everything that was in there, but they basically covered everything that the EF is touching at the moment. So this spans from ETH 1.x to ETH 2.0, research, development, all the infrastructure around it, you know, like new launches, existing products, updates, some stuff about zero-knowledge proofs is in here. There is so much. Like, there's a table of contents for this article because it's so big. So I definitely go read the whole thing, like read it again, just soak in how much stuff's being done on Ethereum, because it got me really hyped. Like, I'm sorry, Vlad, for being too hyped once again, but you know, it got me hyped because like, it's just amazing how much is being done in such a short amount of time. This is all bleeding edge stuff. Like, this research stuff is new. Like, it's new research coming out every day that these people are doing that hasn't been done before. So the fact that it's happening so fast and it is amazing. It really speaks to how passionate people are about this sort of stuff as well. So, you know, there's even updates about EWASM in here, which is really cool because EWASM has been a bit of a closed box, I think, on the kind of marketing side and what's happening with it. Obviously, a lot of stuff around, you know, existing clients like Geth, different languages like Solidity and the Python and stuff like that. Research around, you know, things like Plasma and ETH2. The TLDR for ETH2 research it's happening, which I thought was pretty funny. So yeah, there was a thing about zero knowledge proofs. I'm just trying to scroll through here. So ZK Snark's research, this one line was just pretty stuck out to me. It's like, we are moving forward with ZK rollup implementations and we're becoming more confident in using zero knowledge proofs to scale arbitrary dApps to millions of users. Now, we've spoken about zero knowledge proofs and rollups in the past and how Vitalik spoke about this a couple of months ago now at this stage and how they could be used for phase one in ETH2 to basically get that functionality in phase one. So yeah, it's great to see that EF is bullish on this being, you know, practical and being able to be used. We've obviously got that EIP in Istanbul coming that will reduce the cost of these on ETH1.x as well. So yeah, definitely go read all of this if you haven't yet. I'm sure you've read it, Eric, and I'm sure you have your own comments here as well. So what did you think of this one?
Yeah, no, it's great to see. I guess first and foremost, props to the EF for starting to put out more like transparency and very informative blog posts to kind of what they're doing. I guess anybody that in the past has asked, wait, what's the EF doing or who works for the EF or what have they been working on? Like, this is the blog post for you, right? Like you said, there's a lot of detail in there. The ZK stuff really stood out to me, the E2 stuff. But then, you know, I also wanted to highlight Geth. So I think what I'm most excited about in that post, and Peter of the Geth team has been tweeting some stuff, but Geth 1.9 is coming out pretty soon. I actually think the unstable like alpha version might even be out on their GitHub. I could be wrong about that, but the main release is coming soon. And they've added a lot of stability and size of the sync improvements to the node. So it links to a couple of his tweets. So basically, if you're syncing an archive node, so this is like the most intense, he even put hashtag Ethereum big scary node. So the benchmarks in the old version or in the new version, he got fully in sync in 8 days. So that got up to block 6.6 million. In the old version, 1.8.23, it took him 8 days to get to block 5.37 million. And to do it all, it took him 20 days. So basically a 12-day improvement in syncing of archive nodes. And then on the size of syncing, so for a fresh, fast sync, which is really all that most people need to run and, you know, what's what I would run on my own personal node setup or whatever, now it's 131 gigabytes of space. And in the old version, it's 177 gigabytes. So, you know, that's 20-30% improvement or whatever. So huge steps by the Geth team. So that's really exciting to see. And I'm pumped that we're getting a lot of not only speed improvements, but the space and storage improvements are gigantic as well. So big props to that team. I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Yeah, exactly. I've been seeing a lot of this myself as well. And actually, I didn't link this in the newsletter, but last night, BitMEX's put out a tweet saying that their Geth node had lost kind of like sync with the mainnet, but their parity node hadn't on their nodestats.org website. I tagged Peter in the tweet thread, and he's basically like, what are you guys doing? You have like the, you know, the wrong settings enabled and everything, and, you know, this is how to do it, you know, properly and all that sort of stuff and how to get it running more efficiently, which is quite funny. Like, Peter's definitely an expert on Geth since he's, you know, the main core developer of Geth He knows his shit, knows what's going on. So yeah, it's cool. It was cool to see that as well. But yeah, so yeah, my get since I up since I've been seeing the improvements that Peter's been putting out, I've been pretty excited to get my hands on that as well. So when there's a stable release, I definitely will. Parity's obviously been working on their client too, and obviously we have all the ETH2 clients coming out now as well. You know, Prismatic Labs, Status is Nimbus, and Sigma Prime as well. With their client too, they're just working very hard under the hood. In the background as well. So yeah, great to see all that happening. All right. So last thing I wanted to talk about was, so we've been talking about Ethereum mixers the last couple of weeks. Eric, you put out a tweet saying that you kind of wanted to do a mixer based on Vitalik spec, and out of nowhere, Argent comes out with Argent, the mobile wallet app developer, comes out with this thing called Hopper, which is a Ethereum mixing service. So basically, it makes it so you can do private transfers on Ethereum using a mixing service. It's got a few limitations actually at the moment, unfortunately. So it only works with one ETH send requests, because if you sent a unique value of like 1.12 ETH, it'd become much easier to de-anonymize the transactions. But yeah, it's just great to see that this just came out of nowhere, right? And we were already talking about Ethereum mixers and how we can bring more privacy to Ethereum by using the technology that we already have in smart contracts and things like that. So yeah, I mean, I guess, did you want to talk a bit more about this, Eric? And what did you think of this?
Yeah, for sure. It's been really interesting to kind of watch this evolve. I mean, you and I have talked for months now since the beginning of this podcast of how we need some kind of privacy option, right? Because we don't like creating accounts for new dApps and then linking them to old accounts and people could potentially see our entire history, right? So it's been fun to watch this evolve. I mean, it originally kind of started on Twitter and then a conversation at ETH New York, which Vitalik was a part of. And he kind of, you know, quickly came up with this spec, which he ended up putting on HackMD and went around the Twitterverse a bit. And then Moloch DAO said we would fund someone to help build this. And then Argent just kind of created this repo and created this Hopper, right? And they admit even, I definitely suggest people go read it. So it's on Argent HQ. I believe it's Argent HQ is their username on GitHub, but it's the Argent Hopper on GitHub. And they have a good like explainer article on there of how to get using it, but also kind of the downfalls still. So we still need to decentralize the relay service, which is part of Vitalik spec. But I guess at its very core, how this works is basically you send one ETH to a contract. And then at some point in the future, you can prove to that contract using a zero knowledge proof that you sent it from a different address, this one ETH, and you're able to withdraw it to a different address. Now, what's interesting about this, if you think about it, if you were to send like 0.367 Ether, right? And then you were to withdraw that to a different address, people are still going to be able to trace who you are because it's such a specific amount of ETH. So Argent, for now, until we've kind of like figured out this problem of how you could, you know, send a very specific amount and withdraw it and still be anonymous, has just set every deposit into the contract and then subsequent withdrawal has to be one ETH. So, you know, if there's 50 people using it, it'd be very hard to know which one ETH, because you're all sending the same amount. The other tricky thing is it requires a lot of people to use it. So imagine I want to send from address A to address C, and in the middle, I send it to Argent, this smart contract wallet B. So I send it in, and I was using the iOS Alpha app. So you pick what address you eventually want to send to, and it tells you the address of the contract. And then at some point in the future, you can withdraw it. Now, if I'm the only one using this contract, people are going to know what address I am, right? Because the only two transactions in the contract are going to be my in and then my out. But if you have, say, someone using it every 2 minutes, the longer you wait for more transactions to be in that contract, the more private you are. So if I send in and then I wait 24 hours and within that 24 hours, say, you know, 1,000 people use the contract, it's going to be very hard to know when I withdraw who I was, right? Who my initial input address was. So in the app, it kind of tells you how many people have used the contract since you sent in. So the longer you wait, obviously the more anonymous you would be. If you send it right in and take it right out, it's going to be pretty easy to know who you are. So there's still some issues here around, you know, the relay service of like the ZK stuff. I technically can't speak to too much, but that's in Vitalik's spec and they say in their post, we still need to figure out a little bit better. Hopefully we can figure out to allow people to send in kind of like any amount of ETH that they want and not just one. Although theoretically, like if they just had one 10 or 100 or something, it's still pretty valuable because you could create a truly clean address on the end that you don't have to go through an exchange to do, which is something I do now. You have to send a Coinbase and back out, but I don't like doing that. I'd rather send it to this anonymous mixer. And then finally, yeah, just making sure people use it, right? That's kind of the key in this. So getting it integrated into wallets, and Argent obviously has their own wallet. At Gnosis, we've talked a bit about integrating this into Gnosis Safe. So getting real world use case, but I'm super excited about this. I think Argent might at some point apply for a grant to like further it and kind of fix some of the problems that are still out there. And I know there's some other teams working on those issues too, but I mean, this came about fast. So like the solution for how little amount of time it's been is great to see.
Yeah, exactly. As you mentioned, this is integrated with Argent's own wallet, their mobile wallet. I definitely recommend going to check that wallet out. It's one of my favorites at the moment. I don't think it's got any Web3 kind of stuff going on, like with dApps or anything at the moment, but they definitely have the user experience down and doing a lot of really cool stuff on the smart contract wallet side. I don't know if it's still in early access. If it is, I've got a few codes that I can give to people. So if you downloaded it and you need a code, just DM me on Twitter and I'll be happy to send one out to you. I think Eric's probably got a few codes as well, so definitely DM him as well. But yeah, so excited to see more of these things come online and kind of get cheaper as well. I guess one of the main concerns with a lot of this privacy tech is the gas costs, of course. But like as I mentioned before, there's an EIP in Istanbul that will reduce this gas cost for a lot of these different things. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that, definitely. And I guess we can move on from that. So yeah, one other thing I wanted to talk about was the on-chain activity this week. So I guess the total locked in DeFi kind of spiked because of the price rise this week. So it's now like $650 million worth of ETH, I think. Last time I checked, it's probably still that today. Yeah, it's around $650 million. And then I also noticed that one particular DeFi app has been growing quite rapidly, and that's DYDX. So they launched their kind of new exchange to the public in May. And since then, they have originated about $25 million in loans with over 4,000 transactions. They have, I think, the highest lending rate for DAI. It was up at like 30% at one point. So yeah, DYDX is basically a margin trading platform, essentially where you can go long or short ETH. And I think there's a couple of other, I think it's just ETH at the moment, using margin, essentially. So yeah, this was just really interesting to see because it seems like a lot of these 2.0 platforms, like when they launched, like, you know, we had 0x 2.0 and, you know, Compound version 2 and all these things. It seems when they launch, it's when these DeFi products start getting a lot of attention and a lot more people are using them because they kind of come with those, you know, killer features. So we had Compound come with, obviously, the C tokens, which is, you know, kind of blown up and everyone's been talking about it and everyone's like, this is amazing, like CDAI. Why just pay people in CDAI and they instantly get interest on their DAI without having to put it into a bank account or anything like that on Compound itself. The token itself represents the claim on the assets in Compound, which obviously are earning interest. So yeah, and DYDX does the same thing. It does a similar thing with their margin as well. So you can get the tokenized representation of these things. So yeah, I mean, did you see, have you used DYDX yet actually, Eric? I haven't because I don't trade on margin.
Yeah, I try to stick away from that devil ever since my early Bitcoin trading days, learned some tough lessons there. So no, I don't for the same reasons. I don't trade on margin. I actually don't trade at all anymore, but yeah, it's a cool protocol. Like I've read a lot about it. And when it was one of the like, kind of the early DeFi platforms too. It's been around for a while, but seems to be picking up steam now. I guess my assumption here is people have got a little bit addicted to margin longing ETH, considering we're up, whatever, 3.5 times off the bottom. People have got bored of just getting DAI and just longing it alone. Let's add some margin to it now. I think I like to look at a chart on TradingView, which is ETH USD longs divided by ETH USD shorts. So basically it tells you how many longs there are on margin versus shorts on margin. I think it's like 5x right now, which is extremely high. Although I think the top it was like 8x, which is the all-time high by a long margin. But even 5x is up there historically. So it seems like a lot of people are margin long ETH right now. You can take that how you want it. It can be bullish or bearish depending on how you want to look at it. But just in general, it's good to see, you know, these. I mean, this is an obvious use case for DeFi, right? Like using your crypto as collateral and margin trading on crypto. That's kind of like the first wave we've seen in DeFi, is this lending and borrowing crypto to either long or short. So, you know, we've talked a lot. I'm excited for the next wave of DeFi because personally, this doesn't hit home to me as much. I'm excited to see like the DEXs take off and a little bit more like real assets being traded on chain. I think that's going to be a little bit more exciting, but it's cool to see like more activity taking place on some of these protocols that have been around a little while and are just now finding product market fit. It's really good for those teams.
Yeah, I think the DYDX exchange interface is also really good. It looks like a kind of centralized exchange. It looks really nice, really sleek, really user-friendly. So I think that's what's attracted a lot of people to the platform as well. You know, and obviously because of the bullish market, it's been really great for margin traders too. Even though you can only go, I think it's a maximum of 4x leverage on DYDX at the moment. It's still, you know, I think the most you can in a decentralized way, besides something like Maker, which is similar as well. I think that's why a lot of people got addicted to this kind of leveraging up on Ether as well because of Maker. So yeah, definitely not sure if bullish or bearish. The market's obviously been bullish. We're back over $300 for ETH and, you know, over 10K for BTC, but it remains to be seen if we keep growing from here or if we, you know, dump back down because everyone got too bullish too fast. All right, the last thing I wanted to talk about was a tweet storm from Tony Sheng this week. Now, this was really cool. It was something different, but he tied it back to crypto pretty well. So he was talking about these kind of designer luxury handbags called the Hermes Birkin bag. So I didn't actually know about these because obviously they're made for women, so I wouldn't have any need for a bag like this. But he basically goes through the steps of how these bags are so, so exclusive that there's like a 6-year wait time on them. And a lot of people buy these bags on the secondary markets at extremely inflated prices. So the company just builds this narrative around these bags. So they basically build a narrative saying that, you know, it takes 18 hours to hand make one of these bags. The people who make them require 2 years of training. You know, the people that that make them come from prestigious leather making schools. And if their bags fail the inspection, the bag is automatically destroyed. So they're building this kind of narrative and brand around their bags to portray the image of them being extremely exclusive, extreme luxury, and like a status symbol for people and things like that. So there was a world record here for one of them. One of the bags, it was diamond studded. It sold for $300,000 in 2016. Now, the way he kind of ties it back to crypto is like, what experiments can we play in crypto where we do this kind of artificial demand built around narratives and kind of stories about you know, something like NFTs, right? Basically making a digital good that, you know, is so exclusive and so, you know, cemented in kind of a narrative that it's worth so much money. And it actually reminded me a lot of definitely like video games. Like I played a lot of video games as a kid. There was, you know, one video game I played called World of Warcraft. Like I'm sure everyone's heard of it, but there was one kind of item in that game. It was a mount that you could ride around on the game, but there was only one per server. So essentially you had to be like the pretty much like one of the most well-known or best players on your server to be able to get this. And there was only one, and it's not tradable or anything on the game because obviously it's central, the game's centralized and you don't actually own the asset, but it's a massive status symbol. If you have that, you basically show the rest of the people in the game that you're like an OG, right? You played in the original game. It was back in like 2006 that it was released and you could get it, and you can't get it anymore. And I was just imagining to myself, like, since there's such a narrative and lore around this, like how much would one of these sell for? Because the only way that you could actually sell this to someone else is to sell your whole account. And that's actually against Blizzard, the people who make World of Warcraft, their terms of conditions, terms of use as well. So your account would probably get banned if you did that. But I'm curious to see how this plays out in the crypto space because of the fact that we've got these limited edition NFTs already coming out, and we're seeing them sell for a lot. Like Gods Unchained, there's these mythic cards that sell for a lot. I remember one of the mythic titans sold for $70,000 worth of ETH at one point. And this is just like a digital card for a game that's not even released yet. It's only in kind of this beta stage. So Like as a collector myself, as someone who's played a lot of video games, this really rang home with me, and it also bled into a bit about art as well, which I know that you're interested in, Eric. Your wife's been doing a bit of artwork lately, so did you want to talk a bit more to that?
Yeah, for sure. I guess first, very interesting thread. I guess are there like Birkin maximalists out there that pump and dump the narratives for the bags on Twitter? Because that's what it sounds like. Yeah, I've been going down this path. You know, I've actually been interested in this like digital art scene for a little while. Like I was into CryptoPunks pretty hard in like 2016, which was one of the kind of first digital art movements on Ethereum, and not much is happening there. They sell for a little bit. I think someday they could pop back, but recently I've been kind of diving into all the art dApps and like NFTing art and stuff like that. My wife's been painting some Ethereum art. If she just started crypto Twitter, which I've been warning her is very dangerous, but if you want to follow her Twitter name is Mrs. Ethereum, MRS Ethereum. But so she's been painting these, and we've been trying to figure out how to digitalize them or like NFT them, right? And it just got me thinking a lot about, I do think there's a market here for, you know, proving authenticity of rare art with NFTs. So somehow, you know, you brand it to the artwork or like hide it in the artwork somehow with a radio chip or whatever. Like the most basic thing would be to like tape a QR code on the back of the artwork, right? And then create an NFT for it. And the person that buys the art has the NFT. Now, obviously that can be manipulated and faked, but in kind of going down this path, I saw that Louis Vuitton is thinking about, you know, proving authenticity of bags and products on the Ethereum chain. So, you know, it's an interesting tweet thread about the Birkin bags, and just, I think this is going to be a pretty big use case of Ethereum. So not only, you know, proving authenticity of bags, but like then you're able, they're digitalized at that point. You can trade them. And then you kind of get into this whole realm that you're talking about, which is digital goods, right? So there's a big digital art movement where people are just creating. So you don't paint on a canvas and then digitalize it via an NFT and sell them together. Like my wife's trying to do, you just create digital art and you sell it. Right. And that's kind of like these Gods Unchained cards too. Like all of that is just done on chain, which is another movement. I think they're both going to probably work in parallel. There's a lot of synergies between the two of those. You know, I haven't fully mentally wrapped my head around the digital art movement, because there's still something to me about like a physical good. Like you can see the like the craftsmanship that went into like creating a leather bag or something like that. Like sure, yes, the prices of these bags are ridiculous, right? But you can kind of still see the hours it took to create them. And I know digital art is like that too, but I think it'll take a little bit of time for like our generation to fully wrap our head around that. But I think, you know, one or two generations down the line, like the tweet thread said, a lot of people use those bags as a status symbol when they're out. Well, when a lot of the just activity and social activity of human life is online, people are going to want to display like unique digital goods on their personas online, right? So it's kind of going to be the kind of same concept and just gets transferred to the internet. So I'm definitely very bullish on this movement and idea in general. And it's just kind of getting started. And we talk about DeFi a lot and stuff, but I think this is going to be a pretty cool area to watch play out.
Yeah, I think the digital collectible scene will take off once we have proper virtual reality and people start living in these virtual worlds and things like that. And I think that having a centralized company control those things is not going to play out very well for people, because they're not going to want to have, you know, this thing where their account can get banned or their items can be arbitrarily taken away or modified by these kind of centralized entities. So I think we're going to eventually have like a decentralized virtual world where people will actually be able to display their collectibles in their house or whatever, or, you know, be able to wear different suits of armor and things like that. I mean, there's already a couple of attempts at this, you know, the obvious one being Decentraland, which, fun fact, Tony Sheng used to actually work there. I think that's when we'll see these digital collectibles start playing out a lot more on within crypto specifically, because obviously they're already quite popular in centralized games, like a lot of things like Counter-Strike Go. There's a lot of item reselling that goes on there. Dota 2 as well. Like there's a few very popular games that have these items you can buy, but it's all centralized, and I don't think it would actually work in a virtual world where people actually want to own these things themselves and feel like, hey, I can take this, you know, out of the virtual world whenever I want. No one can take it from me. Just like they came with their Bitcoin Bitcoin and Ether or whatever it is. So I think a bearer kind of digital collectible is going to be very popular going into the future.
Yeah, for sure. And going down this path of the art and like NFT and everything, like I realize how many teams are out there working on this stuff. So I, you know, we should have a couple of them on the podcast. So I guess if you listen to this and you work on one of these teams creating digital goods or art on Ethereum or something, definitely reach out to us and would love to have you on the podcast and talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. And we actually updated our ETHUB section for crypto games. We had someone put through a major update for us on the GitHub, which lists a few of the big games in that are building on Ethereum right now. So definitely go check that out on ETHUB on docs.ethub.io. Cool. All right. That's it for this week, everyone. It was a big week. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter yet or the podcast, definitely go to ethub.substack.com to subscribe. And I think that's it for now. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast.